Hi, I'm Ahmed Chabeddin. Today on the stream, three stories we are following closely. 11 years into the war in Syria, we look at how it's impacting generations of Syrian children. Next, Afghanistan, where the Taliban is once again forcing women to cover their faces in public. But we start in Sri Lanka, where a political crisis took a violent turn this week.
On a daily basis, especially with the skyrocketing prices of essentials, with the current political instability, it's only expected to get worse. There are shortages of food items, only limited stocks released. There are shortages of medicine, and there are huge queues for fuel, domestic gas, and kerosene. And it has impacted the transportation and the system of education as well. The low-income families has got impacted quite a lot because of these issues, and the other part of the society is feeling the impact right now as well. We from Care Station has been helping the affected families with food essentials around the country.
On Thursday, Sri Lankan President Gotabaya Rajapakse appointed a new prime minister to contain protests over his handling of a severe economic crisis. The government is grappling with rising oil prices and the impact of tax cuts. Here to discuss more from the capital, Colombo, is Al Jazeera's Manel Fernandez. Manel, thank you for being with us. I want to kind of get straight to it. It seems like every day the situation is escalating, a political crisis, economic crisis turning into basically social upheaval. What's the latest?
So a couple of hours ago, we got a new prime minister, Ranil Wickremesinghe. He is not new to the role, but it's his latest sort of turn at the post of prime minister of Sri Lanka. He's been serving for a record number of times as prime minister of this country. And this is term number six. Interestingly, he's never yet been able to complete a full term, Ahmed.
Right. And I understand that even though he's been on the political scene for decades, he doesn't have a lot of support amongst the public or the opposition, as you outlined. I mean, it seems like Sri Lanka's economy, as we've been talking about for weeks, as we know, is in a free fall. In terms of, you know, the desperation, for lack of a better word, what's it like, Manel, on the ground? I mean, I've seen the lines, I've seen a lot of footage of people looking for basic goods. How bad is it?
It's getting increasingly difficult to source essentials. Now, there are obviously certain kinds of goods that are in short supply or just not available. For example, cooking gas or now petrol and diesel fuel for vehicles. So those are sort of key things which, you know, every single household more or less relies on. And when you're not able to secure those things, in addition to the fact that, you know, your basic staples are also sort of becoming more and more difficult to come by, as well as the fact that costs of things are skyrocketing. I mean, every sort of visit you do to the supermarket or the grocery store, you need to double check on prices, because the rupee is in free fall. For after a long time of sort of controlling it very tightly, the authorities have now allowed a free float. So all of a sudden, it's skyrocketing. So all of these things put together, surging inflation, 30% plus, is really making it tough for the ordinary Sri Lankans.
And, you know, speaking of how tough it is, let's listen to ordinary Sri Lankans themselves. Take a listen.
We have hit the bottom economically. We earn a living from money made by driving this auto rickshaw. By the time I queue up for fuel and manage to get any petrol, the curfew will be imposed. I don't have enough time to do my job. I will have to go home without money.
We opened our shops, but there is no point. There are no people, but we are just staying open.
You know, I see those people speaking and I hear what you're saying. It seems like concerns are rising. Yet when it comes to the president himself, he's tweeting saying, I urge all Sri Lankans to reject the subversive attempts to push you towards racial and religious disharmony. Promoting moderation, toleration and coexistence is vital. This religious disharmony that we keep hearing about, I mean, Sri Lankans have criticized the speech on Wednesday by the president. I believe it was his first, if I'm not mistaken, Manel, since the protests really began. Where do you see this going? Is he able to contain this politically, economically? Is he going to be able to appease people or to deliver the basics for them not to increasingly get more volatile and violent?
That's what he's hoping, and that's what the appointment of Ranil Wickremesinghe is all about, essentially trying to sort of steer this ship through some very, very choppy waters at present, because his own team, the people that he had surrounded himself with to deal with Sri Lanka's economy, had let him down so badly. Now, there are members of his team, that's the president's team, that have sort of accepted the fact that the president was misled, that he didn't have the right kind of advice from officials. But at the end of the day, these are not sort of surprises. You've had the opposition for months, almost up to a year, if not more, warning of the fact that its debt has been unsustainable, that it is heading towards a major crisis where its foreign currency reserves are concerned. In fact, some of the sort of stronger representatives on the economic side of the opposition had urged that we go in for a sort of a planned default on debt repayments. I mean, this was almost a year ago, but the government just continued in almost a pig-headed fashion, insisting that they were in control of everything. But on the side, they just continued printing money, copious amounts of it to sort of balance their payments. And at the same time, they sort of went on this major trip saying they have never defaulted the country. And indeed, since independence, it had never defaulted on any debt and loans, that they would do this. So we saw the foreign currency reserves plummet.
Right.
And until such time that there was almost no more money in the kitty, then they kind of woke up and started talking crises and started asking everybody to get involved with this kind of recovery. So it was a bit too late.
Right. And, you know, we have a lot of people in our YouTube chat commenting live saying, for example, Rizwan Rahim saying Sri Lanka's economic crisis is a tailor-made one by the Rajapaksa family. And we've also been seeing a lot of those footage, really shocking footage of cars, as you can see on Twitter right here, being dumped into the water there, into lakes. And, you know, it seems as though certainly online that the story is not going anywhere. We're going to keep following it. Minel, I want to thank you for joining us. We're going to have to leave it there for today. But you can also follow all of Minel's reporting at aljazeera.com. From Sri Lanka, we now move to Syria. In 2021 on the stream, we marked one decade of war, but we also candidly asked, does anyone even care anymore? Since then, we've seen other conflicts take over the headlines. But have a listen to what our guests, Dr. Zahir Sahloul and Alia Malik, had to say.
What's happening in Syria is affecting a whole generation of children. It started, the Syrian crisis started with children calling for freedom, and 55,000 of them have been killed since the beginning of the crisis. Their life expectancy was cut down by 13 years in the 10 years of conflict, and they still are the main victims of the crisis. And unfortunately, the international community does not have a solution for them to end this crisis and move towards peace and justice.
You know, children are quite literally the future. And I just think, how can you build a future on, you know, for this generation and with this generation, by this generation, when the trauma is so immense and there isn't really a possibility to remediate it by asking for justice or accountability?
This week, UNICEF warned that 12.3 million Syrian children are in need of aid both inside the country and in the wider region where they've fled since the war began. To discuss this, we have Julia Tuma. She's Regional Chief of Advocacy and Communications for UNICEF in the Middle East and North Africa. Juliet, thank you for being with us. I want to ask you straight off the top, we've heard a lot of different concerns around the welfare, the well-being of children in Syria. What is the most pressing matter on your mind?
Ahmed, first of all, let me thank you for having me, but more importantly, sincere condolences for your loss over the killing of Shirin Abu Aqli. Thank you very much. What concerns us most is the fact that 11 years down the line, the needs of Syrian children are huge. In fact, last week we recorded the highest number of children in need inside Syria. And it was on the eve of the Brussels conference where we have asked for urgent funding that we needed for Syrian children.
Yeah, you know, when we talk about that urgent funding, looking at a tweet from AJ plus wrapping up some of these statistics. You know, Syria Relief saying that over 100 schools will be closed by August. This is obviously going to have ramifications that go far beyond that. You know, we know 1.75 million, that's almost 2 million children in Syria are out of school. Obviously, that increases the risks of them, you know, confronting kind of tougher life realities such as child labor and child marriage. How realistic is that connection? What's the immediate need?
Do you mean for education specifically?
Yeah, like in terms of, you know, if they're out of school, how large is the risk then that they might fall into tougher life realities?
Very large. In fact, we have seen education crisis developing over the past decade. So we're talking about half of Syrian children who need to be in school. They're out of school. And the longer children stay out of school, UNICEF knows that from other settings, the more difficult it becomes to get children back to school. So they do indeed fall prey to child labor and child marriage. And in the case of Syria, we've seen many, many children sadly joining the fighting.
Right. And, you know, it's really tough to imagine. It's been over 10 years, and yet it's so seldom that we actually see any real focus, at least in the media, quite frankly, these days, put on Syria. Andy Warrior kind of talking about this disparity and how far we've come in YouTube, saying to us, I think the world should stop caring and interfering and leave Syrians to fend for themselves. They can take care of themselves. They were doing a pretty good job. Obviously, a little simplistic, possibly, in terms of a criticism, but this notion of who's responsible at this point, Juliet? Where do you try to draw the most attention, or where do you expect to get the most support for these children?
Okay, it's not really UNICEF's concern to point fingers or to say who is responsible. What really matters to us is that children in Syria and in the neighboring countries have been suffering for way too long. And until the adults finish fighting and until a diplomatic political solution is found, we have to all of us continue help children in Syria and in the neighboring countries. The needs are huge. Mm-hmm. The ripple effects of the Syria crisis into Syria's neighboring countries like Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, Iraq, Egypt is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. These countries have been so generous, taking on almost 6 million refugees over the course of the years. We can't give up on Syria's children and the children of the region.
And really protracted conflicts, obviously making that all the more challenging, you know, with what's happening in Ukraine and Russia and the fallout. I do want to ask you before I let you go, Juliet, still in our region, if you will, mental health really a taboo. I do know that thousands of children have been identified as needing psychosocial support due to trauma, and that this also might mean that they're less likely to get that important support. How big an aspect is that in terms of where the needs are for these children?
Huge. The children of Syria not only live in a war, they live in a war inside them. They've seen atrocities that no one should see. I mean, when I was in Syria, I remember meeting a child who was, I think, about 7 or 8 years old, and all he talked about was about death. And he used the word death so many times, and it was just mind-boggling that a child his age knows what death means. He's witnessed death. He spoke about it, and he was just so numb. And it was just one child, and there's many, many children like this. And so the needs of mental health are immense. We do know that children inside Syria, especially those living in areas where the conflict is ongoing, like in the northwest, they have trouble sleeping, they bedwet, they cry all the time, they're clingy. And so that aspect is often underreported and is often unspoken about for a number of reasons, but the needs are really, really high.
I'd like to thank you for speaking to us today in general and about this. Juliet, we look forward to speaking with you again. And now to Afghanistan, where the Taliban is once again requiring women to be covered up head to toe and forcing them to stay indoors. unless accompanied by a male chaperone.
The Taliban's latest order is a very serious escalation in their ongoing attack on women's rights. This order not only orders that women and girls should cover their faces with either a burqa or a niqab when they're outside the homes, it also says that they shouldn't go out of their home at all unless it's absolutely necessary to do so. And the order says that when women disobey, the punishment will be inflicted not on them, but on their male family members, which essentially makes every Afghan man the jailer of his own female family members.
Here to share her thoughts with us, Pashtana Durrani is the director at Learn Afghanistan. Pashtana, thank you so much for being with us. I saw you nodding as we heard from Heather there at the top of this segment. What do you make of what she said, how she framed things? But more importantly, as a young sort of advocate, what concerns you most with what's happening?
Thank you so much for having me and putting the spotlight on Afghanistan, although it's barely in the news anymore. What Heather says does completely make sense, but also at the same time, if you look at it, there is nothing left to ban. Literally left to ban. You banned education, you banned going to school, you banned working outside, you banned leaving the country. So what else is left to grab the international attention? Oh, let's force a hijab or a burqa that's already in practice. I come from a family, my mom hides her face from four of my uncles, paternal uncles, because that's how we are in the rural regions. And that has been in place. And when the Americans or NATO came, it didn't change. It continued to stay the same. And people in Kabul, if you look at the 70s and the 60s and the 80s, people didn't wear the hijab back then either. Not by hijab, I mean the whole burqa. By hijab, I mean they wore proper clothes, fully covered, but didn't cover their faces. So you have to understand that it has been in practice from past few decades. And you can't just say that, oh, we're enforcing a hijab on you.
Right.
Sorry, it's there.
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up and also making the point that there's nothing left to ban. Looking at just our tweet from Al Jazeera English, men and women are not now allowed to dine out together or to visit public parks on the same day. It seems like a lot of measures being taken, wondering what is the actual intended aim. And I want you to speak to that. But because you also mentioned, Pashtana, this idea of the memory, I understand the average age of women in Afghanistan is just under 20 years old. Now, I don't want to ask you how old you are, but I'd imagine pretty close. And you know, in some respects, a relative sense of liberty might be all they know relative to what the Taliban is demanding right now. And most Afghan women's living memories, I would imagine, of this idea of compulsory head and face coverings are also quite limited. What can you share with us about kind of where Afghanistan was and what this, how people, women are processing this on the ground, still protesting?
Well, just so you know, I'm 24, but Google thinks that I'm 25, so that's a sad part. But apart from that, yes, majority of Afghan women are under, Afghan girls are under 20. Most Afghanistan is a young country. And at the same time, it's not just Afghan girls who are suffering right now. If you're expecting a brother to be beaten over a sister who is not hiding her face because she's way too young, but is physically big, it completely loses the motion or the notion that this girl is not accepted as an Afghan in her own country, in her own home, and is not comfortable going outside. Your own country is supposed to protect you for that. That's the first thing. The second thing is, right now, if you look at all these decrees, literacy, workforce, traveling, everything is around women. But you do see that the country is also abusing human rights right now in the northern parts of Afghanistan and even the ex-army officers and police officers throughout Afghanistan. The Taliban right now are not focusing on hungry or the starving or the malnourished. Nothing is being done about that. How many decrees have been passed that the Taliban should actually be using the taxes used from the ports towards the hospitals or the malnourishment wards or the starving wards? Nothing of that sort. But all of a sudden, every now and then, we have a decree on women. Why so?
because they're using women of Afghanistan as for their own political gains. And at the same time, you have to see that 8-9 months ago, we had a country where 30% of the workforce was women. Mm. We had millions of girls in schools. We had, apart from that, women traveling alone. We had women as breadwinners. We had women who were politically representing you in civil rights, representing you internationally. We had an identity. We had a passport that was actually acceptable. And we had a government that was acceptable. And at the moment, none of those.
Pashtuna, I appreciate you saying, you know, how things were and where they are now and where they're headed. I want to also kind of hear from some of those brave women still protesting this latest decision. Take a listen.
Taliban imposed their culture on Afghan women under the name of the hijab. Ever since the Taliban seized power in Afghanistan, all their projects have been against women. They want to limit and eliminate women from the field of society and politics.
We want to be known as a living creature. We want to be known as a human being, not like a slave imprisoned in the corner of the house and have our husbands beg for a piece of bread. We'll never, ever want such a day.
Pashtuna, when you listen to those women, I'm wondering, how do you feel about that?
See, I'm going to be honest. At one point, I am proud that there are women, despite any way out of all this stuff, they are still standing up straight. I mm-hmm. do feel proud. But at the same time, I do feel sad that for the past 20 years, our women were weaponized, used for legalizing this war, and then now, post this, even now, women are used as political pawns by the current regime to have their own recognition and political gains. So, yes, there is a sense of pride, but also a sense of hopelessness and sort of, you know, when you feel down, because that's not what they deserve. They're supposed to be at work.
Right.
They're supposed to be looking after the students, not this.
Are you optimistic, Pashtuna? I mean, we have a question from Andy in our YouTube chat saying, what do Afghanis feel about their neighbors and their role in the plight of Afghanistan? Are they helping or not helping? I mean, looking regionally, looking at the international community, you mentioned at the top of the show that, you know, Afghanistan, unfortunately, isn't really covered the way it perhaps once was. Are you optimistic that things will change for women? And even more broadly, as you made the point, you know, there have been new videos and testimonies that have been emerging online of new executions as well as arbitrarily detaining unarmed civilians. Are you optimistic for the future of Afghanistan?
I think I am optimistic about the women of Afghanistan and the fact that we have risen back in the day, and it's nothing new. This has happened to us again and again. But then at the same time, one thing that I want to highlight is the regional powers have always been against Afghanistan. They have always played a vital role to make sure that the women of Afghanistan are always backpedaled. And I'm currently, honestly, disappointed at the fact that the regional women who are actually Muslim don't feel the same towards their own Muslim sisters who are suffering right now under a regime that's imposing so many laws that are not even Sharia-wise right.
Yeah, you know, it's, as you talk about those women, I mean, what do you think they can do? What is their role?
I mean, like, for starters, the country Pakistan has a lot of women representatives. Why are those women representatives silent right now?
Mm.
Why are they not pushing their own leadership to ask the Taliban to stop doing this to the women of Afghanistan, to open the schools for women in Afghanistan? I mean, closing schools did come from that side of the border. So why aren't they pushing for that? And apart from that, the same goes for Iran. I mean, Iran has a lot of women representatives mm-hmm. in their circles. Why aren't they pushing for that if they really want to stand with the women of Afghanistan?
Well, Pashtuna, obviously, this is a story that's not going away. I do want to ask, you know, we saw the news about young girls, and now we've seen women being restricted. Are girls able to go to school just very quickly? What's the state of that?
No, girls cannot go to school. Girls from grade 6 to grade 7 to 12 are not able to go to school. Yeah,
so essentially it's the same as it was several weeks ago when they prevented them from going to school. Thank you, Pashtuna, for all that context. We have to leave it there today. But remember, if you're watching this at home and you have story ideas you'd like to see on the show, tweet us at AJStream.